You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
It's a difficult one because I am a Republican in the sense that I don't see the point of having a monarchy, right? I find it really, really problematic. I take this talk that they bring in money and tourism and all that sort of thing, and they might be good for business. But I find that in a democracy, I think it's really, really problematic that we kind of worship sort of inherited wealth, inherited status, and these sort of aristocrats who are just there by birth, right? I find that really, really problematic in a supposedly democratic country. It runs counter to everything that democracy stands for, I think. So personally, I have a real problem with it. But as I say, I can recognise that they do some kind of work. I think the Queen herself has been quite extraordinary, given the amount of media scrutiny she's constantly under. So I can sort of recognise, you know, that she's good at her job. I just don't necessarily think the job should be there, if you see what I mean.
Mm. I guess placing yourself now as a citizen of Aotearoa, with some understanding of the kind of colonial process that occurred here and is still occurring, has your thoughts on that changed at all?
Yes, it has, because it becomes a bit more, it's a little bit embarrassing, to be honest, because you're seeing that kind of British imperialism from a perspective of one of the colonies, right? And so you suddenly become quite aware of what that imperialism is about. I mean, I'm well versed in what it was about, but there's something about being here and watching the Brits turn up. It kind of makes you quite acutely aware of what happened and how, to some extent, it's still happening, right? That sort of imperial colonial mentality is so deeply ingrained in New Zealand culture, particularly the Pākehā part of that culture, you know, and to some extent I find it embarrassing. I mean, what's weird is I've come all this way to live in this country and I have to have a day off work to celebrate the Queen's birthday, you know, and I don't even do that in the UK.
You guys don't have a day off for her birthday?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember it.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's like kind of odd. But so it's odd that you come here and it's a celebration, right? We should change that holiday to something else, not the Queen's birthday. There's lots of other good things that we could do here, I'm sure. I find it a little bit, yeah, I do find it awkward, to be honest.
But I guess, I mean, that the point that you make it embarrassing and awkward, you could go further to that. It's sort of, I think for many people, it could be this display of trauma in a way, this kind of...
No, absolutely. I mean, I'm just speaking from my perspective, right? If it makes me cringe a bit to see a couple of kind of British aristocrats to turn up and smile and play lovely with people, right? What's that going to be like for people in this country who experience the sharp, very brutal end of colonialism? You know, we talk about triggering things these days, and I'm sure these kinds of visits awaken all kinds of deeply disturbing experiences, stories, memories, kind of, and also continuing structures of inequality, right? It brings that to the fore, especially when they do this kind of, you know, this tiki tour of a kind of acceptable Māoridom. Do you see what I mean?
Mm.
You know, that's the other thing that I find disturbing about it.
I guess on the other side of that spectrum are Pākehā people here who for so long have understood this kind of relationship to England or to the UK. And the way that this country sort of allows for sort of smudging that past, I suppose. So, like, we do have a holiday for the Queen, but there's often not really any question about it. Nobody really challenges that. Nobody really says, oh, well, we don't have a holiday for when the Declaration of Independence was signed in 1835.
Yeah.
There's sort of that we're allowed to kind of skate past that and not have to feel anything about it.
Yes. Yeah, and I, again, it's difficult to explain why we do that, but I think there's some sort of key aspect of New Zealand that believes it is powerful through association, right? That it's, there was a former powerful country, still powerful to some extent, right? A former power that we have a direct historical connection to. And by maintaining that symbolic connection through things like the Queen's birthday, we also project an element of that power. I think that's part of it. But again, as you say, a powerful statement could also be made about our independence. But in the UK as well, it's all about continuity. You know, part of British history, so the writing of British history is all about the writing of continuity, right? So you could go back and write a completely different sort of version of British history, which is all about discontinuities, right? Points of disruption and interruption and dissent and resistance and all that sort of stuff. So you could paint a picture of British history that's about discontinuity. But that kind of history always paints the possibility of discontinuity in the future, right? So it sets up for the possibility for change, revolution, dissent in the future. Part of the important thing about history writing in terms of power is to always write the past as a process of continuity, and thereby you always set the future as a process of continuity. So this is what I think New Zealand is doing as well, is that it's through the Queen's birthday and these kinds of visits, it's trying to narrate some kind of continuity where the sort of disruption of colonialism, the violence of colonialism, is almost seen as a sort of a natural progression of New Zealand towards a kind of modern world. And it's sort of, there's a sort of seamless connection between where we are now and all the way back to the past of the British Empire, you know, starting with Queen Elizabeth I. So I think ideologically these kind of events, and particularly where they're presented in the media, is to create this narrative of a kind of seamless continuity, as you say, that kind of overrides or hides, masks these moments of disruption, rupture, trauma, catastrophe, right?
And likely for quite specific reasons to sort of forget those things. But I did want to touch on what this kind of was initially about, was the idea around news values and the way that the news media jumps at this opportunity to kind of display every little bit of what the royals are doing when they're here in our country from start to finish, and also the outpouring of people that go to see them, that kind of consume this news as well and are talking about it for the entire time that they're here. And I guess you sort of said the word earlier, this worship. We take it in. Why do we do that? And why does the news media display it?
Well, first of all, it's just nothing but celebrity, right? It doesn't, you know, okay, these are a particular type of celebrities, but they're celebrities. Look at all the celebrity magazines, right? People consume tons and tons and tons and tons and tons of this stuff on a daily basis, right? We live in a culture where we are encouraged, again, to worship aristocracy, whether it's kind of monarchical or whether it's kind of commercial, corporatist, or even sort of pop culture. We're encouraged to constantly worship people who are supposed to be great or fantastic or talented or whatever, or simply people who are just famous, right? And that's, I think, very, very debilitating socially, because it takes us away from actually what are our social issues and sort of projects all our kind of our desire, our affect towards these kind of icons. In that sense, the royals are not really that much different. And of course, the media here is largely commercial, so they need viewers, they need click signals. So they know that this is going to draw people, because people love celebrity. And so they just fill the pages of newspapers, fill our screens with it, because it's what's going to draw people's attention. You know, talking about the travails of the National Party is only going to get you so far. You know, it's not going to draw in the big crowds, even though we really should be talking about that stuff, you know. So that seems to be why they do it. There's a commercial motive, and because we are culturally almost entrained to worship aristocrats of all kinds, whether they're in popular culture or whether they're part of the monarchy. And again, You know, that's a way of saying, well, this is the social structure, right? The social structure is one of gross inequality. But you can momentarily overcome that inequality by seeing how nice these people are. You know, they will deign to talk to you and speak to you and all the rest of it. And it sort of naturalizes social hierarchies. And also, as I said, it's a massive moneymaker. That's why we do it. And it's profoundly sad, I think. But, you know, that's where we're at.
Do you see it changing anytime soon?
No.
Why not?
Because inequality is increasing, particularly in places like the US and the UK. We're not moving towards more equitable societies. Certainly, socially and economically, we are increasing inequality. And so these kind of loving and lovable aristocratic celebrities will be increasingly used as a way of legitimizing those kinds of hierarchies. I don't see it getting better at all. In fact, I see it getting worse.
Then the news media will continue to also take advantage of that?
Yes, increasingly so, because they'll need them more and more as a kind of distraction. You know, as we get into sort of, I mean, you're looking at the sort of growth of white supremacism, fascism, neo-Nazism in the States, right? And you've got a belligerent nationalist government in the UK with a kind of politics that's based on sort of a kind of hatred of the poor and also a scapegoating of the foreigners and sort of non-whites and all this sort of stuff. So that politics of distraction is only going to increase and increase and increase as the people at the top pull more and more money out of the sort of the commonwealth of the economy, right? And people are feeling more precarious and stretched. So I think this kind of, it's not going to go away. I'm not saying necessarily it's going to intensify, but this sort of cultural politics of the deification of aristocrats, right? Whether they're monarchists or people, rich people from popular culture, is just going to increase as a way of keeping us from focusing on what the real issues are, or a kind of a balm, right? Okay, you feel shit, here's someone who can make you feel really nice, look how pretty she is, right? You see what I mean? That's all it's going to be for the next foreseeable future. I mean, the one interesting thing about Meghan Markle, of course, is the fact that she's, as far as I know, the first person of colour to enter the British royal family. And that's important.
But it's still within a framework of the empire itself.
Yes.
It's not going to completely overturn it.
No, absolutely. What it does is say, look, the empire's nice. Because, look, we've accepted a person of colour into our ranks, right? So the empire's nice. It's the same as the myth about the self-made man or woman, right, under neoliberalism. I made it, therefore everybody else should be able to. But that's also what's so dangerous about that myth of the self-made man or woman, right? Because, you know, someone like John Key, for example, he will say, I made it, therefore everybody should be able to make it, therefore those who didn't are somehow deficient, bad, immoral, right? And that's how these things are used. The empire can continue because now it's kind of a little bit multicultural or something. It's disturbing stuff, really, the more you think about it.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.